From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, how did the Texas Capitol end up in Austin? It was the result of a power struggle in the Republic's earliest days that's still being felt today. And the history of redistricting in Texas, how the Republican Party used the federal courts to gain a foothold in the state to begin their rise to political dominance. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. Of course, Texas in the days of the Republic was very different than it is today. There was no city named Austin, but that's where the Republic's and later the state's capital would be built. And that's all due to the vision and determination of one man, Mirabeau B. Lamar, the second president of the Republic of Texas. How that came about is the focus of the book, Seat of Empire, The Embattled Birth of Austin, Texas. Jeffrey Stuart Kerr is the author.
Once Texas had gained independence, there was a prolonged political fight about where to put the capital. And Mirabeau Lamar, who initially gained the ascendancy, had dreams of pushing Texas' border all the way to the Pacific Ocean, and he wanted, therefore, to push the capital as far west as he could. Sam Houston was opposed to this, and this led to the formation of two camps, the Houston Party and the Anti-Houston Party. Lamar won out initially. He was able, when he became president, he got a law passed that established the seat of government on the upper Colorado River, and that's how Austin came to be. There's an interesting story about how he picked this spot or how he came to favor this spot, and this is what got me interested in history in the first place, in Austin history at least, about 10, 12 years ago. I heard this story. Lamar was running for president. He was vice president at the time, and he came out west on a campaign trip and was staying with a fellow named Jacob Harrell in a small town called Waterloo, which was really just no more than four or five cabins. And one morning they were all at breakfast, and Harrell's son came into the room and shouted that there were buffalo in the vicinity. So the men all rode out and grabbed whatever they could to shoot with and ended up at what is now 8th and Congress, right in downtown Austin, and Lamar shot what everybody agreed was the biggest buffalo they'd ever seen. And afterwards, they gathered at the top of the hill where the Capitol now sits, and Lamar was looking down towards the Colorado River, and he supposedly announced to everybody that this should be the seat of future empire. And that is a great story. If it's not true, I don't want to hear it.
Let's talk about the geography of Texas at that time. The borders of Texas that we know today, they weren't all exactly the borders of that time.
Well, and that's true. And back then, people didn't even necessarily agree on what the borders were. Lamar's idea was that Texas extended westward when he became president all the way to the Rio Grande River, which included about half of modern New Mexico. And that was his initial pretext for sending an expedition out the way to invite the New Mexicans to join us, which is a big focus of the book and one of the big reasons that he wanted Austin on the Colorado River, because he was trying to reach out and capture that trade. So the borders were in flux, and there was a big dispute with Mexico after we gained independence about what they called the Nueces Strip, which was the land between the Nueces River and the Rio Grande. And then, of course, it extended to the northwest all the way up into bits of Oklahoma and Colorado and elsewhere.
That invitation to New Mexico, some people would call that an invasion.
Well, that's exactly what the Mexicans called it. Lamar listened to some advice that turned out to be bad advice. An American merchant named Dryden had been over there to Santa Fe, and he came back with stories about how the people of Santa Fe were just waiting for this invitation to join Texas and anxious to establish a regular trade route. So Lamar organized a supposed trade expedition. Now, a lot of the party was armed. It was a military escort, but the pretext there was that they needed protection against Indian attacks. They got lost. It was a lot longer than they thought it was going to be. And, of course, when they got there, the Mexican governor saw them as an invasion, and it ended in fiasco. It kind of disgraced Lamar, and really, at the time, most people that weren't ardent supporters viewed his presidency as a failed presidency because of it.
That and also the fact that he certainly was no economist.
That's right. The country was rather poor going into his administration, and certainly all but bankrupt at the end of it.
The Texas Redbacks, which was the money of the time, he printed a lot of it, and it had no value.
that's pretty much the truth of it. And he had, you know, he wanted to fund this expedition. This is one of the big things that bankrupted things. Congress approved it. Everybody was kind of in favor of it, but never did actually allocate funds for it. So he had to kind of dig around here and there and come up with the money. And a lot of it was privately backed. A lot of merchants jumped on board thinking they'd make a fortune. But as I said, it was just a fiasco for everybody.
So let's get back to the concept of where Texas was going to have its capital. And it was an independent country at the time. So we weren't just picking a state capital. We were picking the national capital. Why put it in the middle of nowhere? Because that's where it was, with Waterloo, which was not really a town at the time, but you had San Antonio, which was a well-established town. It had been the capital of Coahuila, which was the huge state that encompassed Texas and also Mexico, big chunk of Mexico, you know. And Houston was a pretty fast-growing little brand-new city, right?
Houston was. It's interesting that a lot of people, when I talk to him about the fight over where to put the capital, they think that Sam Houston was against putting it in Austin because he wanted it in the town named after him. And that's really not true. He, like most other people, weren't all that pleased with Houston, which was really just a collection of tents and cabins and kind of a muddy, mosquito-y place. But he wanted it in the more settled portion of the state. Lamar specifically wanted it out west, preferably on the Colorado River, because he and a lot of other people believed that this would entice New Mexico to join us. And the idea, at the time, there was this very lucrative trade that traveled overland from the Mexican territory of New Mexico, from Santa Fe all the way up to St. Louis and then into the United States. And a lot of people were getting wealthy on this. Lamar's idea was to reach out and divert that trade to Texas. And what he envisioned was, they thought it was only 400 or 500 miles from Santa Fe to Austin, or to what became Austin. And from there, they intended to take this overland trade and our goods and load it on boats and float it down the Colorado River to the Gulf, load it on ships from there and take it to the east coast of the United States. And if that worked, it would cut weeks or even months off of the overland route through St. Louis. Of course, just about every assumption they made proved to be wrong, in particular the distance and then Mexico's willingness to let this happen.
So
why he wanted it on the Colorado River, because he envisioned that eventually that Austin would be this great metropolis, this great trade center that would divert all of this Mexican trade to us.
There were feelings that San Antonio would not be an appropriate place for a capital because it was considered to be too close culturally with Mexico.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. It was still identified as a Mexican town.
So how long before Austin began to take shape as an actual community and settlement began attracting people to go live there?
Well, right off the bat, there were lots of people that came. This was a big, exciting thing. And a lot of people really believed in Lamar's vision. And, you know, there were several hundred people pretty quickly, a lot of them connected with government. And then all of the infrastructure, the store clerks and everything else that were required to support these folks. What almost spelled death for the city of Austin was when Sam Houston became president and the Mexican army twice came as far north as San Antonio. And Houston, who never wanted the capital that far on what he considered the exposed frontier, used that as an excuse to pull government out of Austin. The town, you know, over the next couple of years until the capital came back in 1845, the town nearly withered and died. It got as low as about, I'd say, a couple hundred folks, and, you know, the buildings were deserted and things were pretty bleak there for a while.
Mary Abu Lamar, he's a very fascinating character. I mean, how do you feel about him as an individual? Do you like him?
I think he's really, I do agree that he's fascinating. I think overall he's not a particularly sympathetic character. But what makes him interesting is just that he was such a contrast in a lot of ways. One of the things that fascinated me in researching his story was that when he was a schoolboy, maybe 13, 14 years old, he was given an assignment in school back in Georgia to respond to the question, were the Europeans, was it right for them to acquire land in the Americas in the fashion in which they did? And he took the stand that no, they had, that Europeans had absolutely no right, that conquest does not gain you legitimate possession of land. And yet, 20 years later, he was one of the most genocidal or at least ethnic cleansing supporting politicians of his era.
I mean, he drove the Cherokee out of Texas.
And he said on multiple occasions that any, you know, if they wouldn't submit, then we would exterminate them. Now, he wasn't alone in saying that, but he certainly followed through on that threat with the Cherokee and attempted to do so with the Comanche and any other Indian that tried to stand in the way. So when he looked out west and saw that all of West Texas was filled with Indians, that was not a consideration for him at all. Those people were going to have to go, according to Mirabeau.
Now, he had a remarkable career as a soldier, fighting for the Texas independence.
He left Georgia not in disgrace, but he'd lost a couple of elections. His wife had died. His brother had committed suicide. I mean, he was just heartsick and heartbroken and very discouraged. But he decided to move to Texas, left a daughter back home in the care of some relatives, and came, looked around in 1835, went back home. But then he heard that the revolution had started, and he got back to Texas as fast as he could and joined up with Sam Houston's army as a private. And then at the Battle of San Jacinto, he, like a lot of other people, were mortified that Sam Houston had not turned and fought sooner. On the skirmish the day before the big battle, he did a couple of daring things, one of which he rode out exposed and saved Thomas Rusk from the Mexicans during a skirmish, and then another incident where he saved a boy named Walter Lane. And this instantly made him a hero in his comrades' eyes, and the events kind of went quickly, but he became the leader of the cavalry.
So this is the famous runaway scrape that the Sam Houston's army of ragtag fighters, militiamen, fleeing to the east, away from the Mexican Santa Anna's army, and Sam Houston is hoping that Andrew Jackson is going to come save the day. Of course, that never happened. And then there were some officers in the army that just said, no, we're going to go fight, when they heard about the Alamo. And then they cornered Santa Anna's forces at San Jacinto and were basically able to just wipe them out. Mary Beau Lamar may have been one of the captains who were very vocal in demanding, let's go fight.
Right. And of course, people argued for decades about what Houston's real motives were and what everybody else was saying. But this whole escapade is what convinced Lamar, one of the things that convinced Lamar that Sam Houston was a coward and a poor leader of men. He even claimed later to have been standing or sitting on his horse next to Sam Houston right before the battle. And Sam Houston was evidently, according to Lamar, dithering about whether or not to attack. And he supposedly asked Lamar, you know, gosh, should we do this? As if he was afraid to do it. This is what Lamar claimed. Now, Sam Houston later said that was not true. But that fed fuel to the fire of this personal animosity between the two men.
It's as interesting about the book is that you see so many things about Texas, about where the cities are and how the growth came and the battles, and they could have turned on a dime. They could have turned out differently.
Oh, absolutely. I think at the very end of the book, I mentioned this, it's not inconceivable to think that the city of Austin or this site would now just be a historical site with a marker the way Washington on the Brazos is. But for a twist of fate, that would be the major metropolis. And it's just incredible to think how different things would have been.
Jeffrey Stuart Kerr is the author of Seat of Empire, The Embattled Birth of Austin, Texas. It's published by Texas Tech University Press. Recently, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a ruling in the case Shelby County, Alabama versus Holder. The decision gutted a critical part of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, the cornerstone of civil rights reform from the 1960s. That ruling will have an impact on redistricting in Texas and will make it more difficult for minority voting rights advocates to prove in court that the new redistricting maps approved by the state leadership discriminate against Latino and African American voters. Redistricting has always been contentious and controversial in Texas, but there was a time that it was the Republican Party in Texas that was taking the state of Texas to federal court and arguing that the maps were discriminatory against them. This is covered in the book Rotten Boroughs, Political Thickets and Legislative Donnybrooks, Redistricting in Texas. It's edited by Gary Keith. David Martin Davies spoke to Keith via Skype, He's in Germany teaching history over the summer.
It plays off of historical, political, and legal dynamics around redistricting. Rotten boroughs were the legislative districts in ancient England where people left them to go into jobs in the city, but members of parliament got to keep their seats even though they weren't representing very many people. So the boroughs had rotted from the inside with people not being there. And so the American forefathers literally said, we do not want rotten boroughs in America. And thus they created the census and reapportionment and redistricting to make sure that districts move to where people are. So that was the rotten boroughs part of the title. And then political thickets comes from a Supreme Court decision in which Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter wrote that the court should not get involved in redistricting matters because it was a political thicket and there would be no way of getting out of that thicket. And he was in the majority at that time, but that majority did not hold. And finally, legislative Donnybrooks. Donnybrook is the old Irish fight where you'd get a mob scene and people just knocking each other down. Donnybrook, and we get that in our legislative setting.
Your book shows us the history of redistricting in Texas, and it's amazing how, as we look at the events today, that we have basically flipped the script on it. It used to be that it was the Republicans who were legislated out of power, and the Democrats were using every trick in your book to keep them out.
That's right, and this is a typical pattern across the United States. Whoever is in tries to use redistricting to lock in their power and minimize the power of whoever is out. So Republicans used to be out, now they're in, the roles have reversed.
But also, here's one thing that both sides have in common. Both have been accused of using redistricting and other tricks to try to keep Latinos from going to the polls.
Yes, because the old Democrats, when they were in power, trying to keep themselves in power, were almost all white. And so everyone else is an out-group, Latinos, blacks, Republicans. Similarly, now Republicans who are in power are predominantly Anglo. And thus, if they were to give seats to Latinos, they would be giving them to Democrats. So it's a dicey situation where you get party issues and race and ethnic issues mixed together as we have right now.
We also see in your book how the federal government has gotten involved in the past to force Texas to redistrict in decades when it refused to, and also to change up the way that the one person, one vote, an idea that many of us take for granted at one time in Texas, it was not the rule. So what was the federal role, and what were some of the Supreme Court decisions that forced Texas into the redistricting methods and the voting styles that we have today?
Well, in one sense, we have to go back to the Civil War and the post-Civil War amendments that guaranteed voting rights, but those voting rights were not really enforced until Congress passes the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And so before 1965, people would go to the courts and say, please, you've got to step in and give us equal representation. And the courts said, we're not going to do that. It's a political thicket. Until Baker versus Carr in 1962, where the court said, you know, it made a political thicket, but this is also an issue of constitutional equal representation, and thus there must be a judicial answer when people are saying that they have been discriminated against. So the federal courts said, yes, it's okay, you can come to us and we will take these cases. And boy, have they. Ever since 1962, Texas and other states have been going to the courts saying the legislature's plans for redistricting, Congress and the state legislature, do not provide equal representation. The courts have had to decide on a case-by-case basis whether that is true. But then after 1965 also, and here in Texas, the Voting Rights Act started applying to us in, I think, about 1975, lawyers were able to go to the courts and say, Congress has passed an act telling us that we must provide equal representation, and we are arguing that the legislature has not followed that law as much as the Constitution. So there's both the constitutional issue and a federal statutory issue at play in redistricting.
Sort of the tug of war of power that we see in the Texas legislature is between a rural and urban representation. There's complaints even today that the rural areas have a disproportionate amount of power in the Texas legislature. And you build a case for showing the history of how that came about. And it really used to be a way out of whack not that long ago.
The rural incumbent legislators definitely used redistricting to defend themselves and keep themselves in power. Interestingly, what has happened in the more recent decades, though, the last couple of decades especially, is that as parties have grown in importance in Texas, they have taken a more dominant role rather than the urban-rural dynamic being the governing force. It's been more the parties trying to create districts that would be safest for themselves. And so many of the rural districts have actually been carved up to be anchored in suburban districts, given now that the Republicans are in the majority and Republicans are stronger in suburbs. They will use the suburbs and go through the rural areas to link suburbs so that they can get a stronger Republican district. So many people are arguing that rural areas now have lost their influence because there are few pure rural districts now. They are instead attached to an urban or suburban area.
There was a critical Supreme Court decision that changed the way that Texas redistrict, that really gave Republicans their footing and allowed them to grow as a party in Texas. And I know that George Herbert Walker Bush was at the forefront of making that happen.
Yes, and again, we start with the Baker versus Carr decision in 1962, which triggered the lawsuits. Well, the lawsuits came out of Houston. So there was a Democratic lawsuit, and then there was a Republican lawsuit, with the lead litigant being the chairman of the Houston-Harris County Republican Party, George Herbert Walker Bush. And so in the Bush case and the parallel Kilgarland case, we got challenges to the congressional and state legislative districts that created a big fight in the 1965 session. And that's really where the book begins. Well, I explore some of the history before then, but 65 was the first real battle that happened, knowing that the courts had forced them to do the redistricting and that courts would be looking at what they did. And as a result of George Bush arguing that Republicans were underrepresented unconstitutionally, and Kilgarland and the Democrats arguing that the plans discriminated against Democrats and minorities, courts agreed with both of those, and the legislature ultimately had to draw plans that resulted in districts that Republicans could win and some labor, liberal, and minority Democrats could win, whereas they could not before.
And that created a Houston district that was a district that George Herbert Walker Bush eventually won as a congressman.
Absolutely. And so he would never have gotten his career started without that.
As we said, we flipped the script, and now we have Democrats who are going to the courts and minorities also still continuing their fight to get equal footing and equal representation through redistricting. We hear a complaint from the GOP in power now that it's improper to go to the courts to seek relief in some of these debates, but they're in power now today because of action from the courts.
Courts are, like it or not, a permanent part of the redistricting landscape now, and everyone knows this, whether you're in power or out of power, and so courts are used as a punching bag. You go to them when you need them and you think they will help you. When someone else goes to them, as they will, then you argue that the courts should stay out. And that's what's happening now.
Gary Keith is the author of Rotten Boroughs, Political Thickets and Legislative Donnybrooks, Redistricting in Texas, published by the University of Texas Press. He's also a professor of history at the University of the Incarnate Word in San Antonio. Guilt and desperation, two dark motivators that frequently drive people out of their comfort zones to confront some antagonism or conflict. This is the running theme in a collection of short stories titled Signed Confessions. Many of the stories take place here in Texas, and they were written by San Antonio native Tom Walker.
In each one of the stories, the male protagonist has something in his past that he's hung up on. He wants to talk about it. He wants to confess. And he tells us about it, but he doesn't get the forgiveness or the pardon that he's looking for in the process, because really the only person who can forgive him is himself. And so the pardon eludes him.
So we're talking about some stories that have some darkness.
I would say a great deal of darkness. There are seven stories, and they're very long short stories. I know that sounds like an oxymoron, but they are not novellas, but they're long short stories. What one thing I don't like about short stories is that usually about the time that I'm starting to really get into the characters and like them and understand them, the story is over with. So these are long short stories about men seeking forgiveness, redemption, what have you.
So why did you go in that direction? Why is this a male-dominated collection of short stories?
Well, I gave a reading in Austin at a bookstore called Book People, and the story came up, why don't you have any female protagonists? And I told them I would gladly have written about women if I thought I knew anything about women. That didn't go over very well, but at least I was being frank.
So how much of that is autobiographical, Tom?
Well, I think all of your work is autobiographical in a sense, because it comes from a wellspring of personal unconscious. One of the stories, Ode to Billy Jeff, was inspired by the late Billy Lee Bramer, a novelist who wrote probably the best book ever written about Lyndon Johnson. It was called The Gay Place. And I was a friend of Billy's, and I worked with him, so you might say that was autobiographical. The first story, called Blessed Are They That Mourn, actually was inspired by a case of multiple murder and suicide that occurred in San Antonio in 1953. A schoolmate of mine was involved, and I was not directly involved in the case, but I did keep a scrapbook of it, and that was autobiographical. A fourth story, the last story in the book, which is called Going Down with the Ship, was inspired by an autobiography I wrote for a very prominent military personage here in San Antonio who's dead now. I don't want to mention his name. I don't want to embarrass his family. But there were a lot of revelations that came out as I was writing the book for him, and I used them in the story, which is called Going Down with the Ship.
Tom Walker is a writer who lives in San Antonio. He's written the book of short stories, Signed Confessions. It's published by Prentice Hall. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm Yvette Benavides. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. And you can comment on our website, tpr.org. Texas Matters is also available free on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.